I'm Amy.
And I'm Jess, and we're the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Because Potterheads are far too nuanced to be shoved into just one Hogwarts house.
Each week, we will cover two chapters in the saga of our favorite boy wizard.
All the while exploring literary themes, famous quotes, and even fanfic speculations.
To connect with us, your fabulous hosts, and other listeners, join our Facebook group, the Raven Puff Common Room.
Thank you for tuning in, grab your butterbeer, and enjoy the show.
Welcome again to the Rambling Raven Puffs.
Welcome to the show, everyone. I'm Amy.
I'm Jess.
And today we're covering Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, Chapters 3, The Letters from No One, and Chapter 4, The Keeper of the Keys. In these chapters, Harry tries to open a mysterious letter in front of the relatives who hate him, like a dum-dum. And knock-knock, better than the relation coming to take him away, he's gonna go to wizard school. And joining us for these chapters is a very special guest. Please welcome Lisa Desaulne. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Amy. Hi, Jess. Thanks for having me.
Of course. Lisa is a YA author who gave us an exclusive interview on our Sublimely Gothic podcast about her novel, The Puppet Master's Apprentice. I'll leave the link for that in the episode details. Now she has returned to us to showcase her inner Potterhead. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us, Lisa.
It's my pleasure. This was fun homework to do.
Indeed. So, first, tell us about your personal relationship with Harry Potter and how you got exposed to the series.
Sure. So I was actually in college when the Harry Potter books started coming out. And so I knew right away that this series looked like something I would absolutely love. But I kind of decided I would save them as a treat for when I had kids someday to read them aloud with my kids. And so fast forward now several years into the future, and I have a 10-year-old and an 8-year-old, and we read them aloud together. So we're reading them. We're halfway through book 4 right now. And we've been really enjoying the new illustrated versions that have come out recently. They're wonderful. So anyway, that's where I am personally in reading the books. I've seen the movies, but just absolutely love the story and Harry's world. So it was fun to go back and reread these chapters and just remember how great they are.
I'm curious, when did you start reading them? Like, what were the ages of your children when you started reading Philosopher's Stone?
We got the first illustrated book in 2018. I gave it to my daughter for Christmas, and I think she was had just turned eight maybe at the time. And so they were, I think, 8 and 6. And it's taken us, we read 1 to 2 a year and kind of try to grow them up as Harry and Hermione and Ron are growing up as well. So it's been a lot of fun doing it that way.
Some powerful restraint too, Lisa, because sometimes, Amy, when we talked before, she was like, don't read ahead. Please don't read ahead. And I was like, no problem. You know, we do the other podcast as well, Sublimely Gothic. And then a couple of times I've been like, I'm not going to cheat. Trust me, I am an honest person. But so I can't imagine sometimes putting off, the next book in the series.
Yeah, it's been hard. And there's times too where my 10-year-old, who's a big reader, she'll say, Mom, can I please just take it into my room? And like, can I keep going? And I'm like, nope, you have to wait till we can all read it aloud together. We're doing this together. So anyway, it's been a good exercise in patience doing it that way.
Yeah, and for me, certainly this isn't my first or second or even third reread of the series, but doing this podcast as it is my first exercise in just reading 2 chapters per week, because I never used to do that before. I would just whiz through them the whole series in several weeks. So that's new territory for me as well. But yeah, I was just curious about how old your children were, because if there's, there's a lot of criticism about Harry Potter and how suitable it is for kids, a lot of it religiously based that I do not agree with at all. The only thing I am genuinely curious about, with Harry Potter and like parents is, because when they were coming out, the books came out several years apart, so its audience matured and grew and was able to deal with the darker things as they got older. But now that they're all done, just thinking as a parent, like some of that stuff, even in the early books, is really dark.
It is. Yeah, that's a great question. And it's something, probably every parent will have to decide for themselves, like what is your child ready for? And so that's kind of why we've been doing just one a year and kind of pacing ourselves. And so it's been kind of nice to do it that way. And then we always celebrate after we finish the book. We watch the accompanying movie, and that makes it really fun. So my girls enjoy the Star Wars and all the Marvel movies. And so I felt like they're kind of at the stage where they're ready to handle some of these bigger fantasy stories. And so it's been fun to do it together.
Cool. All righty then. Thank you so much for that. Again, just genuinely curious, because, again, the general rhetoric around the fandom is that the end of book 4 and 5 onward is, like, the super dark stuff. But I'm like, when you really think about it, if you were to just change the tone a little bit in the first few books, there's some pretty creepy crap.
There is. And I think the beauty of reading them aloud and reading them together is that gives me opportunities to talk about stuff with my girls. So if scary stuff or dark stuff does happen, you know, we can kind of pause and be like, okay, do you guys understand what's happening and how do you feel about it? And so it's nice because it gives you those conversation opportunities.
Mm-hmm. Great. So again, we are doing chapters 3 and 4. So starting with chapter 3, The Letters from No One. Jess, again, it's been a while since you've tackled Sorcerer's Stone, quite a few years. What were you feeling going into chapter 3?
Well, this is kind of like the, and Lisa, unlike Amy and you possibly, I've read the books once, I appreciated them, and this is like my first reread. So, you know, and I don't even remember when I read these last, maybe when I was in college. I'm not sure. But this is kind of getting to the parts of this book that I remember. And, you know, part of it is like, do I remember this because it was so vividly depicted in the film? Or did it just like stick with me? I don't know. But the letters in Hagrid, those are the kind of two big themes, I think, if we wanted to take away, like, if I wanted to assign a word for each chapter, it would be the letters. Well, letters and Hagrid.
Yep.
Yeah. And what were your general thoughts rereading these chapters, Lisa?
I really enjoyed them and remembered how much I enjoyed them. And kind of like Jess was saying, sometimes it's hard now that you've seen the movies and read the book to kind of remember like what, when I'm re-envisioning it in my mind, am I remembering the movie version or the book version? But my general thought from chapter 3 was just that reminder of how frustrating it is that Harry cannot get a hold of like a single one of his letters to read them, and it drives me crazy. And so that was just kind of reminding me of this sense that we have from Harry, like he feels really powerless and you feel kind of powerless right along with him. And so that really like tugs at your heartstrings, I think. It makes you remember what it's like to be a kid where you have to go where other people tell you to go. You don't get a choice always in how you live or what you eat. And so I feel like that was just like that really stuck out at me in chapter 3, as well as the fact that this is really setting up Dudley to be this super spoiled, greedy, overindulged brat and idiot. And right. I feel like, you know, this book especially really sets him up in that role. And it reminds me a lot of Roald Dahl's books. He often has the characters that remind me of Dudley, like Augustus Gloop or Mike TV in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory or Bruno and the Witches. So anyway, those were some things that stood out at me from chapter 3 in particular.
Interesting allusions to Roald Dahl. I have like his complete collection on my bookshelf from childhood. My favorite was Fantastic Mr. Fox.
The Fantastic Mr. Fox, is that what you said?
Yeah.
That's I love that movie. I know. I don't know if I read the books, but the little Wes Anderson claymation I love it.
Yeah, I love his writing as well. His books are awesome.
Yeah. So chapter 3. So basically it talks about Harry basically got held up in his cupboard for the boa constrictor incident. It kind of implies for many, many months. It's the longest they kept him in there because they were so mad.
Yeah. Well, which we all know how I feel about the being under the cupboard with the spiders. And then they reference it again that, you know, that he slams the door and some spiders fall down, which a credit to some of the writing. I don't know. I always appreciate some of those, you know, something that almost seemed forgettable, but then it's kind of reintroduced very carefully and kind of not in your face. It's not, Harry doesn't drone on about the spiders. I'm going with your theory, Amy.
Yeah.
That it's just kind of like, and then that happened again. So it's, I think that's a clever bit of writing there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, one thing that got to me on the first page of this chapter was the rest of them were all quite happy to join in Dudley's favorite sport, Harry hunting. And I just have a note of how morbid. I don't know why that stuck out to me more so, like, you know, Dudley's being set up here, as Lisa said, not just as an indulgent, not just a brat, but a full on bully, where he takes pleasure in terrorizing Harry.
Yep. I think that allusion is a little more, I think we had talked about, Lisa, last time Amy and I talked, the kind of world that this was written in, you know, then versus now. And even though it wasn't, we're not talking about like some of the books we've read in Gothic literature written in the 1800s and things like that. This is, I don't know, 20 years ago, maybe. And 25. Yes, 25. Okay. Harry hunting kind of, it was like, it might have been a little less weighted than reading it now. I kind of had the same response, Amy. I was like, oh God, what are we talking about?
Yeah. And it just kind of reminded me of, like, you know, I live in a gated community with a lot of wooded area. And in the Facebook group of like our neighborhood, someone was like asking, can I like shoot a bow and arrow and like hunt deer in this place? Like, is that allowed? And I don't know if it technically is or not, but I just made a comment on the post like, please don't. I sometimes go out in the woods and pick up trash, and I don't fancy being shot with a bow.
Right.
Yeah, definitely not.
So it goes into exposition that for the first time, Dudley and Harry will no longer be in school together. Dudley is going to Vernon's old private school, Smeltings, and that's just... exactly the type of school that Uncle Vernon would go to. And Harry is going to be banished to the local public school. And this isn't the first time, but when I was reading through, when Aunt Petunia is, what is she doing? She's dyeing those old, Dudley's old clothes gray so you know, Harry can pass them off as the school's uniform. That always gets to me because it shows the contrast of, like, again, the type of neglect and the type of abuse they engage in. Because honestly, isn't it like, which is more important to them? Is it more important to put in all this work and dyeing something yourself so that you can humiliate this kid with crappy clothes? Like, honestly, like, even if I were like an abusive or negligent person, I don't think I would want to put in the energy the way Petunia is in dyeing these clothes. I would just buy something at a thrift store. So like, it just like that specific one really like had me weighing, like, you know, what are the different forms of negligence and abuse and stuff, because it just, again, it seems way too much work for on Petunia's side to want to do that.
Yeah, she's definitely, you feel like, going out of her way to dye clothes in the sink or wherever she was dyeing them. It is really interesting, that little detail.
That struck me as well. And I think that, you know, like you said, the energy put into it, you know, there's some people do these things out of necessity, and that's just a totally different, you know, situation. We know that they have the means that they could buy a uniform for Harry. You know, maybe they send him to a different school, but they don't have to send him to dyed gray rags, which I can't imagine. I mean, in my head, I see what that looks like, and it's not. So first of all, he's got oversized clothes, and then he has them dyed gray, and he said he looks like elephant skin. Is that what he said?
Yeah, lumps and wrinkles of elephant skin.
Not a good look, not a good way to make probably a first impression, which I guess there's part of that, you know, intention with Petunia and Mr. Dursley is like constant humiliation, I guess.
Yeah, which in a way in itself is so counterintuitive because they're so obsessed with image, and Harry, though they don't like him, is from their household. So even if they don't like Harry, like they don't even from a public stance, they don't want to like even bother to like put up even a little bit of an image in Harry's sake, which is again why Jess and I were wondering, you know, last episode, how the hell did social workers not intervene given how obvious it was?
I think another thing that stuck out at me that was kind of interesting that you see, and I think this is a way that Harry is different from me, being in Harry's circumstances, I think I would be like really timid and probably pretty cowed and bullied by the way that they treat him. But I feel like in this chapter in particular, you know, he shouts at him and he's like, I want my letter. That's mine. You know, so it's kind of you see Harry's anger at being treated the way that he is. And that's kind of nice to see. Like, he stands up to them and he asks for what is rightfully his. And I think that's really brave, because I don't know if I was his age and in those circumstances that I would be able to do that. So,
yes. Yeah, so, yeah, he gets his letter. Well, first, it's get the mail, Dudley, said Uncle Vernon. Make Harry get it. Get the mail, Harry. Make Dudley get it. Poke him with your smelting stick, Dudley. And I think that's something that the whole fandom agrees in regards to the movie. Not that Daniel Radcliffe didn't do a good job with Harry. It's just in certain times he didn't quite convey the sassiness and the sarcastic wit of Harry all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And especially within these interactions with, you know, the Dursleys. So Harry goes out into the hall and he's shocked that there is a letter for him. And he's like, you know, he doesn't have anyone that he writes to. Like, he doesn't even have a library card, so this can't even be a library notice. But not only is it to him, but it's the cupboard under the stairs, number 4 Privet Drive, Little Wing Jing, Surrey. And again, the only thing I can justify is the way what he does next is like just the sheer shock of it. He's still in shock mode and he's not thinking very that far ahead. And so he goes into the kitchen, gives Uncle Vernon the rest of the mail, and tries to open his own letter. And then, but of course, he is unable to.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. It just drives me crazy that they won't let him see one.
And I'm just thinking, you know, Aunt Petunia knows when her own sister went to school. Like, they knew this was going to happen. Like, you know, what did they think was going to happen?
We get to kind of see in the next chapter the repercussions of them not, because I think that was a question I had, like, you know, how much did these muggles know about that? And apparently it's kind of revealed in the next chapter that they knew more and were told to relay more information than I originally thought reading this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was surprised. I just noticed the little detail of, like, the wax crest. It's already the Hogwarts seal, where we get the lion, the eagle, the badger, and the snake. So even as early as chapter 3, we get the iconic Hogwarts house animals.
Yeah.
Which I didn't quite remember.
Oh, go ahead. And I guess that was kind of like when I assumed that some of the robes that the wizards were wearing about town were maybe related to their specific houses. So it is interesting. And again, something that I don't think I remembered when I was reading this, all the information that's given up front, you know, before we actually are at Hogwarts.
Harry is, of course, confused, because even though he's curious about his letter, he's not as confused by Petunia and Vernon's reactions, because, of course, they don't want him to be happy in any way, shape, or form. But what is suspicious to Harry is they don't want even Dudley to know, and they even tell Dudley to get out. So that is very telling that, from Harry's perspective, it's not just about, like, he's part of it, but it's not just about him. Like, they're willing to even not indulge Dudley or give in to what Dudley wants because of this.
Yeah, and you're right about that. And we don't see hardly any other instances where they treat Dudley that way. So obviously this is a big deal.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then Vernon and Petunia was saying in a quivering voice, look at the address. How could they possibly know where he sleeps? You don't think they're watching the house? Watching? Spying? Might be following us? Muttered Uncle Vernon wildly. And, you know, this always ticks me off is when Vernon comes and says, Harry, we've decided you can have your the other bedroom upstairs. They only give it to him after they see that someone might be watching them. So at the court, they know that what they're doing to Harry is despicable.
Right. It's kind of back again with that, where were the social workers? Because somebody, I'm sure if somebody observed them, you know, they are so image conscious, I think, that's apparently what does it. And if somebody would have said, like, hey, Harry looks like kind of a mess, maybe they would have taken some sort of action, because that struck me too, Amy. It was only like when they kind of thought, somebody's watching us. Oh my gosh, maybe we shouldn't treat this kid as horribly as we have been, that they make any change.
Yeah, and I think it's also, and it's not just moving in the new bedroom, it's also Uncle Vernon is in a way trying to appease Harry, try to be nicer to Harry. Like, I don't know, and I don't know how, why that's he's trying to do that. Like, it could be a variety of things. It could be, you know, seeing a letter is like the real proof that that I have a wizard in my household who could, like, you know, do something magical to me. And so in that way, he's more scared of Harry, because even though he already knew what he was, like, just having that physical letter is just further reiterates that. And so is, or trying to appease Harry in the sense that if we treat him better, then he won't want to go. I don't know.
Yeah, it's there's this weird like tension there where you feel like they don't want Harry to go to school, but they clearly don't want him to go to wizard school, but they clearly don't want him in their house and with them either. So it's like such an awkward, he's like Uncle Vernon's wrestling for control there, I feel like. What he wants is control over Harry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And then so Harry does not get his letter, but the next morning there were several more. And then after that, they increase exponentially. So, like, what is your theory behind, like, the sort of magic of this letter sending? Because I personally see it as sort of, like, automated email. I think of it as, like, the magic that whatever in sending out the letters, the magic didn't, like, go to a person. The magic spell just, like, registered that, okay, the kid didn't open his letter, so we're going to send more in a different way. And then we send more and more and more and more and more. Like, I don't think there's actually a person that decided, a witch, whether McGonagall or whoever, decided to put the letters in the eggs. I think this is a purely automated response because the kid isn't opening the envelope. So what do you guys think?
I love that theory. I think that feels kind of right to me. I definitely, it feels like, especially when the letters start coming with such force and they're like zinging Uncle Vernon in the back of the head, they definitely feel like the letters have some sort of like agency or mind about them, you know, and they're just going to get in whatever way they possibly can. So,
yeah. And even, I can't see a witch like McGonagall or anyone at the school being sending off a letter like the cupboard under the stairs. Yeah, the kid lives under the stairs. Let's tell him that. I think, again, I think this is a purely automated like spell that just knows that is digging in its like hard drive for information and just spits it out.
I think that makes the most sense to me. The thing that I thought about was like when I'm like perusing a store online and then put things in my shopping cart. And then I get this little email a little later, like, hey, you didn't check out yet. You know, it's like, hey, by the way, this is people are loving this. You should buy it. And it's the same kind of concept as what Amy said. I thought about that as well. I don't think it was any sort of little creature delivering this. I think it was like a automated email. I like that.
Yeah, but, and again, poor Harry, he still can't get his letters, and he decides, okay, I'm gonna sneak out early in the morning, get the post directly from the postman, but what does he trip over? He trips over Uncle Vernon.
That was so weird to me. I just want to say really quickly, for somebody, it's like a contradiction of he's so concerned about what he looks like, and then somebody's like sleeping in a sleeping bag on their stairs. Like, that's just weird. I just imagined somebody in my neighborhood doing that. That's what I was like, what if I like looked across the street and, you know, my neighbor was just sleeping on a sleeping bag all to like trip their kid? That would be so weird.
Yeah. But it's the stairway in the house. Like, the neighbors can't see it, right?
Oh, for some reason, I thought he was outside. I don't know.
No, I think it was in the doorway in the interior of the house, I think.
Okay. All right. Well, in my mind, I was like, what are you doing outside? So I took it to an extreme.
Yeah. That's really and then, funny. Yeah. Did you have any other thoughts, Lisa?
No, I just think it's funny. In the illustrated version, there's a really funny picture of Uncle Vernon basically like just getting super mad. And he basically has like his sort of giant bum sticking up in the air, boarding up everything. So there's not an image of him sleeping in the sleeping bag, but it's pretty close to that. And it's just funny, makes me laugh.
Yeah. And so what I found interesting also is, you know, when he gets to a point that he decides to like, you know, nail up the mail slot. See, he explained to Aunt Petunia through a mouthful of nails, if they can't deliver them, they'll just give up. I'm not sure that'll work, Vernon. Oh, these people's minds work in strange ways, Petunia. They're not like you and me, said Uncle Vernon. And I found that was interesting. And again, and then by extension, all the crazy things that Uncle Vernon does to try to get away from the letters is, you know, he's not the one with the muggle relative. It's Aunt Petunia who had the witch sister. So you would think, you know, for as little as she knows, Petunia's gonna know better than Vernon about how magic works. And I think it's a real testament to the sort of power dynamic shown in this chapter between Vernon and Petunia, that even though Petunia has way more experience with magic and observing it than Vernon does, she still just goes along meekly with anything that Vernon does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very, like, subservient to him and his whims.
And I don't know if that's, like, just a general, he's very controlling, or this is just a really soft, sensitive point for her, and so, like, she doesn't want to admit she knows more, and so she just goes along, pretend to let Vernon handle everything, even though she knows it's not going to work. Again, really deep stuff going on with Petunia that we don't get any sort of outburst until next chapter.
Right, right.
But then it gets to a point where they're going, you know, letters keep coming, and finally they leave the house.
Right. Yeah, that's a bit of a dramatic turn. You know, they can't escape the letters. Like, honestly, if somebody's sending me a letter that says, you sleep in this bed on this side of the house in this, you know, like, I'm going to probably assume that they're going to find me, even if I run away from my house. But apparently they didn't. They thought, well, let's just leave the house and it'll be fine.
Yeah, and then, so they first go to a hotel, and they get the letters at the hotel, and then, but then also they go to, they basically go on the shack on this rock in the middle of a lake.
I was just going to say, I think, I like the part where Dudley says, Daddy's gone mad, hasn't he? Because I think Dudley, it's like starting to dawn on Dudley, like, this is crazy, what we're doing is crazy, so it's just funny to hear that coming from Dudley.
Yeah, you're right, because, again, Petunia knows why, even though she doesn't, she knows deep down it's not going to work, but Dudley has no idea, and so Dudley's just looking at this, and again, from the way we look at it, and I think the actor who plays Dudley pulled this line off really well, Daddy's gone mad, hasn't he?
and we kind of talked about this a little bit, that Mr. Dursley starts treating Harry differently in these situations. And this is the thing that I remembered in the car trip or whatever, is Dudley's like losing his mind the whole time, which is, he say it's like his worst day ever. And he's being very, very dramatic about everything.
Mm-hmm. And he's like, and he had so many TV shows that he wanted to watch and he missed all of them. Such a pity.
I mean, it is a bummer when you miss your stories, but...
Yeah, I remember when we were tied on our podcasting, one of our episodes earlier last month, because you had to watch Rudolph, the claymation classic.
Yes, I did. Yes, I love Rudolph. I do have a copy of it, but there's just something about it on TV. I don't know.
I love that.
So eventually they go on this shack in the middle of a lake, in the middle of nowhere. Well, I think it's called Cokeworth. And that town ends up being, we don't know about that town later until like book 7, but it's, let's see. So yeah, found the perfect place. And again, just Uncle Vernon says, I've got rations and basically some potato chip bags and some bananas. Like, I just feel so bad because last night my husband and I did the whole extreme kebab dinner where we cooked them in our fireplace.
Oh, nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because we can't cook them, like, on our deck because they won't let us because some stupid idiot left his barbecue unattended and said, set a condo complex on fire.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so now all the complex owners must suffer for that one stupid one. So, yeah, so whenever we want kebabs, we have to do it in the fireplace. So I can't imagine just being in this cold, dark, damp little Like, honestly, it reminds me of the Shrieking Shack from book three, kind of.
Yeah, I can see that. It seems pretty miserable.
And then Harry realizes, oh, I'm going to be turning 11 soon. And so he starts counting down the minutes, then counting down the seconds, and then boom, the whole shack shivered as Harry sat bolt upright, staring at the door. Someone was outside, knocking to come in.
I really like that last sentence. That was one of my quotes that I really enjoyed. I feel like the whole shack shivered and Harry sat bolt upright staring at the door. Someone was outside knocking to come in. That's just, because you're just instantly like, who can it be? Who is it? That's great.
Like, when you first read this, Lisa, who did you think it was going to be?
Well, I had seen the movie, so I knew that it was Hagrid coming. So for me, it was spoiled, but my girls had no idea. So, I mean, they're completely clueless. So the surprise element was definitely there for them.
And now we move to Chapter 4, The Keeper of the Keys, which is a title we don't really hear in reference to Hagrid beyond really the first or even the second book. He's just the groundskeeper after that.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't really think of him as the keeper of the keys. The groundskeeper, yes, but...
I love Dudley when he jerks awake. Where's the cannon? He said stupidly. Which, in a way, is an appropriate guess after just being groggy and just waking up for a bit large sound.
Yeah, a little weird. I don't know. I know I've said some weird things just out of waking out of sleep, so... Can't really blame him too much for that.
Was the first thing... I forgot what the first thing he said was. Couldn't make us a cup of tea, could ya? It's not been an easy journey. And I just read that again and I'm thinking, that is so British.
he's such a gentle giant. And that's why I think everybody loves Hagrid. Although he shows also in this chapter that he can be not gentle when he needs to.
Yeah, but I've always liked... the gentle giant trope, because it's so true, like both in humans mm-hmm. and even in animals. Like when I would ride horses, like, and there'd be people around me who maybe didn't, were a little more scared of horses than I was, and they would be so intimidated to ride a taller or larger horse. But honestly, personality wise, like the big horse, the larger horse knows he could crush you, and therefore he doesn't have an attitude. He's just really nice and sweet. Whereas the shorter horses have to prove more, and so they're more bitchy and temperamental. And I'm like, give me the 17-foot horse any day. Like, they're so much easier to deal with rather than the little ones. So I think it's just part of basic, you know, not just human psychology, but all sentient being psychology, that when you're bigger, you don't have to prove anything or don't have to prove as much.
Yep.
Because your physical presence just speaks for itself. And in Hagrid's case, it allows him to not be shackled by various tenets of toxic masculinity.
Right. I was thinking, Amy, I'm glad you said that, because it made me think of, you know, women are kind of often told to make themselves smaller so we don't take up space. And then just kind of like to contradict that in some things that I've read and just trying to, you know, do better at things. It's like, take up the space, or, you know, a lot mm-hmm. of, you'll notice little subtle ways that people do that in a work environment. Oftentimes it's just like spreading their stuff everywhere to say, this is my space. I have also noticed, I'm not very short. I'm pretty tall. And if I wear heels, I'm even taller. That's kind of a fun thing sometimes, if you need to make sure everybody knows that you're not joking around, just to kind of, if we're in a, you know, person, just that it's just interesting to see human behavior around height and, you know, taking up space. So Hagrid takes up a lot of space. So he means business, I guess, as you know, if you were to first see him, the automatic kind of thought, I think, just because of that space taking, is intimidation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And to your point too, Jess, I like that he doesn't apologize for the fact that, you know, he's a giant of a man. And so it's like, I think sometimes when in descriptions, we'll hear people that are very tall say, like, you know, they stoop or they try to like minimize their height or blend in, but Hagrid doesn't act that way at all. He's just himself and he's comfortable, I think, being himself. And so, and you can imagine to a 10-year-old boy, like Harry looking up at him, you know, I'm sure he's huge, but he's so gentle and so kind, and he doesn't apologize for taking up the space that he does. He's just himself, which is really cool.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. You know, I consider myself, I'm 5'5". I'm pretty average for an American woman. But one thing I did notice is that when I would go abroad to like the Middle East, like Turkey and Morocco and places like that, women tend to be shorter. And it made me kind of realize, you know, now I know my Viking blood makes me so tall, because there were some times I would feel like an Amazon, like amongst yeah. all the women. But then I remember there was a rare person where I did see a woman, a Moroccan woman, who was really, really tall, not just taller than me, but taller than most women. And I'm just thinking, what is it like being a really tall woman in a patriarchal society?
Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's not very fun. But
yeah, that's got to be tough.
Anyway, but we digress. Hagrid is huge and we love him because he's the gentle giant that he is. I think the fact that Hagrid doesn't understand how little information Harry is working with is a further testament that all those letters, again, was pure, like, magical email, if you will, because I think more people would have, if there were people behind it, then more people would have asked questions, and they just said, oh, they finally looked at their database and was like, oh, Harry hasn't gotten his letter, Hagrid, go get him.
I think the fact, like, I feel the same sense of frustration about Harry not getting to read the letters as I do when you realize everything that Harry hasn't been told. And then I think Hagrid expresses that frustration, like, that the reader is feeling really, right. really well. Because you're like, finally, yeah. somebody gets it.
Like, Hagrid is so offended and is so incensed and outraged that clearly Petunia and Vernon did not do all that was instructed in the letter that Dumbledore gave them.
Rightfully so. I mean, they don't even make the argument. I guess I've dealt with some people that can be a bit spineless in things. And it's like, they don't even make the argument like, oh, it was for Dudley's sake. We like didn't want him to know anything weird. Like they didn't do it. And they're kind of not really apologizing for it. At all. They're just kind of like, no, nope, they're why not. Like, would we want to do that?
Yeah, certainly they're intimidated by Hagrid's presence, but they're not sorry about it at all. And honestly, I think Dumbledore might probably knew what Petunia and Vernon were like, maybe not how bad they were, but I think he deliberately put all of his stuff in a letter because he knew if he sat down and really discussed the implications of having a wizard child, that probably Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon would not have taken Harry.
Right.
So yeah. I think there's that part of it as well, where by doing it in just a letter and having no physical contact when the transfer of Harry was made, that, you know, Aunt Petunia and Vernon were allowed to get away with this for as long as they did. And now it's all coming to a head with this confrontation with Hagrid.
One of my favorite things about this chapter that I noted is, like, Hagrid starts taking stuff out of his coat. And I felt like he's like a Mary Poppins character with her magic carpet bag. Because this coat, it's like he's pulling out a tea kettle and sausages and a poker. And, like, basically he has, like, a walking kitchen all within his, like, big overcoat. And I just love that. I thought that was so fun.
Yes, and he's cooking the sausages, and he gives Harry some. And then Dudley, of course, can't resist food. And Vernon's like, don't touch anything he gives you, Dudley. And then the giant chuckled darkly. You're a great puddin' of a son. Don't need fattening anymore, Dursley. Don't worry.
That kind of attitude toward Dudley continues.
And it pretty much continues until book 5, until we get a little more nuance out of Dudley. But yeah, when he gives the sausages to Harry, who was so hungry he had never tasted anything so wonderful. Like, have you ever been that hungry where even the most mundane thing tastes so good?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Usually it's while I'm, like, camping or you've been outside all day and, like, you come back and sit down and, like, a hot dog just tastes like the best food in the world or something like that.
Gosh, I'm trying to think that I know when my husband and I have traveled and we'll just, like, you know, go a million miles an hour and then we'll be somewhere and we're, like, you know, reflecting back, it's like, was that food that really good, or was it, were we just so hungry, you know? So
I think my worst one was one of those 12-hour flights, you know, from going from US to the Middle East. I don't know which country, but apart from Air France, I will like not touch airplane food.
Air France has the best bread. They're like bread. It was always so good.
I know, because they're French and they care about their culinary presentation and heritage.
Thank you.
But everyone else, screw it. And, you know, I would, again, I would be on these really long flights and then finally get down and just whatever was in the airport food court nearest my terminal. Oh, so good.
Thank you.
So Hagrid introduces himself as the keeper of the keys at Hogwarts. And Harry's like, what's Hogwarts? And Hagrid's like, said what? And then just Harry starts to be like, I don't know what you're talking about. And then finally it gets to a point where Hagrid turns on like the Dursleys. And Uncle Vernon, who had gone very pale, whispered something that sounded like Mimble Wimble. Hagrid stared wildly at Harry. But you must know about your mom and dad. I mean, they're famous. You're famous. And yeah, so I feel really bad for Hagrid in this situation. Not like, of course, he's naturally offended and upset for Harry on his behalf, but also he's thinking like, am I truly the person that should be giving this kid this very sensitive information? Like he really, like he wants to inform Harry to the best of his ability, but also he has that little like, should Dumbledore be doing this, or like someone more prominent or more important than myself? But he ends up, you know, caving in and telling him everything.
Yeah, and I think when I'm reading through this part, it just reminds me that it's like, it's kind of two losses for Harry, because it's like, not only does he not know about like his wizarding heritage and his magical abilities, but even just as a kid, like he doesn't know anything about his mom and dad, that his mom and dad were famous, that, you know, like they, and obviously the Dursleys have lied to him about how they died. And so it's like, you just kind of feel so sad for him that he's like missing out on these huge chunks of his past that Hagrid has to share.
Yeah. And what do you two think? Like, do you think Harry is more hurt by being denied the information that he's a wizard, or being denied the information that his parents were like murdered? Like, I tend to veer towards the latter, but what was your guys' feelings?
Yeah, I'd say I'm also the latter. I think it's just more sad that he, like, to have to grow up with a family like the Dursleys as the only family and parents that you know, and to not have any information about what kind of people your mom and dad were, that would just be so sad, so hard.
I think it's like also a situation where it's you think one thing, like he thinks his parents died in a car accident, and you kind of build this story or whatever in your head to have it be something completely different. I don't know if either of you have received information that kind of just makes you a little like woozy. And I was imagining Harry getting that information and kind of being like, oh my gosh, I feel lightheaded. Like, this is a lot to take in and kind of digest and kind of rewrite the things that I've, my beliefs that I've had up until this new information. And then also to have that all compounded by the fact that these people who are in charge of my care, be it, you know, using that in the loosest sense of the word, lied to me for years.
Yeah. And I think one thing, I think the Dursleys, it's not even, it's not directly stated anywhere, I don't think, but it's kind of implied by maybe some characters like Aunt March in book 3 and stuff like that, is that through saying that your parents died in the car crash, it's implying possibly that maybe that accident was self-inflicted. Maybe James, his dad, was drunk or something like that. Like, even if they didn't want to tell him magical stuff, like, they could have said, yes, your parents were good people, but they got murdered, and that sort of stuff. But they even deny him, like, that truth in a non-magical sense.
Yeah, like, which is so cool.
Like, they don't even give the chance for Harry to think of his parents, like, fondly, and just the idea, even if they don't want him to know that he's a wizard yet, but still, it's just really yucky. And like, I don't know. Yeah, again, I think it just shows the level of hatred and sibling rivalry that Petunia is willing to completely dismiss and repress the memory of her sister, that not even giving her the proper respect that is due to that she, you know, died in trying to protect her child.
Yep.
But first, before we get into all that, Harry finally gets his Hogwarts letter, which is signed by Minerva McGonagall, the deputy headmistress. And of course, an Uncle Vernon's in the background, trying to say, stop, I forbid you. And it's like, Uncle Vernon, how are you going to stop this at this point?
Right. He's been more successful than he's been surprisingly successful up until this point. Like, it was his life's mission in the last chapter to make sure none of those letters got to Harry.
Yeah. And again, I think the lack of contact there was between the Dursleys and the magical world, be it Dumbledore or whoever. And again, I think they kind of deluded themselves to think that if they just didn't respond, they would finally leave them alone. But of course, that's not what's going to happen. And so here I want to focus on Petunia. You knew, Harry said, you knew I'm a wizard? Knew? Shrieked Aunt Petunia suddenly. Knew? Of course we knew. How could you not be? My dratted sister being what she was. Oh, she got a letter just like that and disappeared off to that school and came home every vacation with her pockets full of frog spawn turning teacups into rats. I was the only one who saw her for what she was. A freak. But for my father, oh no, it was Lily this and Lily that. They were proud of having a witch in the family.
Yeah, then you could definitely see her jealousy coming out. Obviously, she was jealous of her sister.
Yeah, and it makes me think of why she and Vernon spoiled Dudley so much. Because again, we don't know what sort of relationship Petunia and Lily had with their parents, with Harry's grandparents. Like, maybe from an objective standpoint, they did as best as they could to treat the sisters equally. But clearly, that was not Petunia's perception. And so I think part of her, like, constantly spoiling Dudley is to fill that void of, like, I wasn't the witch, I wasn't the favorite sister, so I'm going to do everything within my power to show my kid how special they are and trample on this other wizard boy that's now in my house.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes me feel like she must have felt like she wasn't special. And so I think you're right. I feel like everything she like lavishes on Dudley is probably the way that she would have wanted to feel. But then obviously we get Dudley out of that situation and he's completely spoiled and greedy and rude and horrible.
Any thoughts on Petunia, Jess?
I highlighted that part of that section. That was one of my quotes because it's kind of like the big reveal as far as her motivation in her attitude was, I was the only one who saw her for what she was, a freak. But for my mother and father, oh no, it was Lily this, Lily that, proud that they had what you just read as well. And that just kind of, to me, was like, okay, well, there's the reason she's acting like she has been. And, you know, probably pulled Mr. Dursley over to her side by saying, I don't know, I'm just thinking about, you know, relationships with in-laws and things like that and vilifying people. And she definitely did not feel, she definitely saw the wizard person in her family was treated well. So in an effort of retaliation against her family, I guess, she's taking it out on Harry, which is just that, you know, that way of thinking is not very sound, but people act in funny ways.
Yeah. And it's, again, it's sort of, she has so much, can't help but think, if she has so much resentment, why on earth would she even agree to take Harry into her home?
I thought about that as well. And I could not come up with any. I'm like, if they care so little about this kid, they're like, making him wear elephant clothes and whatever, like elephant skin clothes, then why didn't they just be like, peace out, go have fun on the street? Like, does this modicum of compassion eventually show? I think I asked this in the last podcast, and I don't think it ever does.
Yeah, I feel like that's a great point, and it's not something I've ever thought about before, but when you ask that question, it makes... It does make you wonder why do they keep Harry around? You know, that, like I was saying earlier, it's like they don't want him to go to Hogwarts, but they also clearly don't want him with them, and they don't, you know, enjoy him or love him. So it's kind of a strange situation.
And it's just extra perplexing to me because I'm just one of those people that if you agree to do something, like, you don't do it grudgingly, you don't, like, make passive-aggressive remarks. If you do it, you just shut up and do it well or do it graciously. If you can't do it graciously, then just don't do it at all. And so, like, I'm just really into, like, that sort of mentality. So, again, I could never do the rationale that Aunt Petunia does in this.
I guess maybe I have seen the opposite, grudgingly doing something and then maybe doing it a little underhandedly and spiteful. I think, Amy, your path of decision-making is a much better way to live. So
I'm just don't take pleasure in being petty. So if I'm in a position where the only pleasure I can get out of a situation is to, like, jab at them or do things underhandedly, why am I in that situation in the first place?
Yeah, I'm just too tired all the time to think about all of that. I would just rather, like, not, do it or not. Like, I got, life's too short to...
Yeah, like, there's a situation, at my work where there was some confusion over who was responsible for doing these certain tasks and certain tasks that are no longer in my job description because I'm in a slightly new position. And certain people were, like, wanting me to do this uncompensated. And I was just like, no.
Good for you. That's
like, I'm not going to do all this work and feel resentful about it. So I put my foot down. It's like, if you want to create, like, a sort of schedule or the proper way to, like, document all this labor I do, then yes, I will do it. But if you're not going to do that, then no, you guys have to deal with it.
That's good.
But anyway, so then we get beyond just the, realizing that Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon lied to Harry and concealed things from Harry. Then we get into the whole actual story of how his parents died.
Yeah, that I was thinking about this when we were talking about it a minute ago. Has he ever seen a picture of his parents up at this point? Or
not that we've been told, I don't think.
Because in his cupboard, I had just imagined, like, it was nothing. He didn't have anything. He talks about in the previous chapter about moving his stuff, which was like nothing, maybe like one trip up the stairs and everything was moved. So I felt like if he had a picture of his family, then, or his parents, it would have been mentioned. And I guess that lack of compassion that is there, mm-hmm. He definitely probably wouldn't.
Yep. I kind of like one of my quotes that I liked in this chapter was, it says, as Hagrid's story came to a close, he saw again the blinding flash of green light more clearly than he ever had remembered it before. And he remembered something else for the first time in his life, a high, cold, cruel laugh. And I think it's interesting that, like, Hagrid's visit is kind of jostling those memories of the past, because that may be, like, literally all he has is impressions and memories. He doesn't have pictures or, things like that to remind him. So, but I really liked that quote. And obviously we know who he's remembering there, but right. Harry didn't really know yet, so.
Yeah, and so Hagrid tells him the whole story of how his parents were killed, that Lord Voldemort targeted them, killed both of them, and tried to kill Harry, but for some mysterious reason, his spell did not work on Harry, and not only did not work on Harry, but also, like, ricocheted or, like, sort of backfired against him. And, like, this wizard, about 20 years ago now, started looking for followers. Got him, too. Some were afraid, some just wanted a bit of his power, because he was getting himself power, all right. Dark days, Harry. Didn't know who to trust, didn't dare get friendly with strange wizards or witches. It's funny, the dark days, Harry, because there are so many memes online now of people, like, there's a little picture of Harry. It's like, tell me about, like, 2020. And then there's the picture of Hagrid, like, dark days, Harry.
It fits.
It does.
So then he realizes that this is why he has the scar on his forehead. This is the scar that came from Lord Voldemort trying to kill him and failing to do so. And that's a lot to put on an 11-year-old.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, like I said a moment ago, kind of like information that kind of makes you lightheaded. I feel like that's what I was talking about. It's a lot of information. And then I'm glad you mentioned that, because remembering that he's 11, like, I don't know. I mean, I don't have kids. My nieces are 3 and I think 9. So I guess similar age. I can't imagine how that they would receive that information or anything like that, digesting that information. So Lisa, do you, like you mentioned when something dark happens in one of the stories, mm-hmm. you kind of take time to discuss that with your kids. Is there anything you want to share about some moments like that in the book?
Yeah, I kind of will stop if my girls have questions or I can tell they have like a worried look on their face or something. But, you know, this part, they didn't stop me at it at all. And so I think that, I don't know, I think maybe it's the difference between reading it versus maybe seeing it on the screen. Maybe sometimes when we see things like in movies, it's a little more scary than it is when you're just reading. You might have like a little more of a separation from either the material or a little more chance to like control it in your imagination. But they didn't seem scared at that part. And so I would have definitely chatted through it with them if I felt like they, you know, needed to or wanted to ask questions. But you know, I think that these stories, what is so great about them is like, there's all kinds of like overcoming challenges and painful pasts and, you know, bad things happen. And so I love that these stories give you the chance to work through those things and talk through those things. So, and to deal, you know, deal with things with bravery and courage and care about telling the truth. And so, yeah, that's what I think is so great about these books.
Yeah. And then at this point, Uncle Vernon steps in and is like, "Now you listen here, boy," he snarled. "I accept there's something strange about you. Probably nothing a good beating wouldn't have cured. And for all this about your parents, well, they were weirdos, no denying it. And the world's better off without them, in my opinion. As for all they got, getting mixed up with these wizarding types, just what I expected. Always knew they'd come to a sticky end." So, you know, a lot of, I'm certainly not the only one. Many people within the fandom have made these allegories of, you know, them trying to repress Harry's magic in a way, in a way that we could look, have an allegory in our world about conservative parents trying to repress the homosexuality of their children or the transsexuality, mm-hmm. like trying to think of something that is an innate part of oneself as being able to change that because being what they are does not fit nicely within the parameters of their societal expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, probably nothing a good beating wouldn't have cured. Again, this makes me think that Harry was abused physically a lot more than he writes in this book, but just for the sake of keeping it PG, he never mentions it.
Mm-hmm. I think that makes me think, just since we're talking about that, we mentioned the abuse last time, and I guess like, for a kid, it would be probably really distressing to read about. I mean, for an adult, I don't like to read about people getting hurt. So, I kind of wondered a little bit too when I read that line if maybe it was more prevalent than we thought, or, you know, who knows? Distressing nonetheless. I don't think any of us right now want to be Harry Potter or in his situation. As far as living with the Dursleys, that is the point here. As far as being like a powerful wizard, well then, I mean, I would love that. So,
yeah, for sure.
And so Harry asked, you know, "Did you know who died and vanished same night he tried to kill you? Some say he died. Cogswallop, in my opinion, don't know if he even had enough human left in him to die. Some say he's still out there biding his time, like, but I don't believe it. People who were on his side came back to ours. Some of them came out of kind of trances. Don't reckon they could have done if he was coming back." So yeah, there's this whole question, and Justin and I discussed this last episode. If there's no body, then you can't presume someone's dead, especially in books like these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially when magic is involved.
So Hagrid tries to proceed by saying, "Yep, you're going to go to Hogwarts." And Uncle Vernon is still trying to, like, say no, which again makes me wonder about the legality of the wizarding world with the fact that there is a wizarding child under the guardianship of two Muggle relatives. Because there are some instances where Aunt Petunia and Uncle Vernon do have a little bit of a power and authority over Harry, even in the magical world, where even magical people want their signatures for certain things, but clearly they're not in enough authority figure to say that no, we won't let him go. Like, so it just makes me interesting again, the legal dynamic of, even if they were a kind, like, loving family, how much power would they legitimately have over Harry legally?
Yeah, that's like one of those unanswered questions that I'm sure there's somebody has like is there like a legal issues of the wizarding and like non-wizarding world? I feel like you could.
I'm sure someone has created that book on like Harry Potter and law, and I think it's on Amazon. I think I saw it. I don't know if that's the exact title, but I know there's at least one.
Good for them. Good for them, because that's very interesting.
I was going to say too, I like how right after that, so obviously Hagrid just like reaches his boiling point with Uncle Vernon, and he pulls out his umbrella and basically uses that to blast at Vernon and Petunia and Dudley. And again, I was like, this reinforces my Mary Poppins metaphor, because yes. Now is he like have this coat like a carpet bag, but she obviously has a magical umbrella and Hagrid does too. So I just thought that was another fun little tie.
Well, how do you guys feel about, you know, Hagrid is angry at Vernon because he says, I'm not paying for some crackpot old fool to teach him magic tricks, you know? And Hagrid's like, never insult Albus Dumbledore in front of me. And he points his wand at Dudley and gives Dudley the pig's tail. How do you feel that Hagrid went for the minor child rather than actually Vernon?
Didn't think about that, to be quite honest. I mean, it's kind of an interesting, like, we talk about like the Dursleys taking out all their animosity toward Lily on Harry. So it's almost like Hagrid's like, well, I'm going to take out my anger toward you on your son. Maybe that's why he does it. I don't know.
Yeah. And I think in adult Harry writing these, like giving his perspective, he basically sees them as one unit that completely hates him. Whereas, you know, as the books have gotten older and the fandom has talked about it, you know, thinking about, you know, separating Dudley from Vernon and Petunia. And again, seeing him, even though he's abused in a different way, but still like suffering significant damage at the hands of Vernon and Petunia and their parenting styles.
It makes me kind of wonder, now that I'm thinking about it too, if it's that could also be Hagrid relating to Harry in some way, where Hagrid, I think we kind of learn later on, was picked on and bullied and treated like he's different from everybody else. And so maybe he sees some of that in Harry, in himself, and probably recognizes that Dudley's like a huge source of that type of bullying. So maybe that's why he goes for Dudley first in some ways.
Yeah, and I just love his line of, was supposed to turn him into a pig, but I guess he was already so much of one anyway that just the tail was left. And so basically, Hagrid decides to camp out with them, and they all go to sleep, or whatever sleep is possible after such a night. And that concludes chapter 4.
Quite the introduction to a character, I think. The Hagrid character. He makes an impression.
I agree.
Yeah. Lisa, with your experience of you're like halfway through the series, like what's your general feelings towards Hagrid?
Oh, I adore Hagrid. I think a lot of it, he's Harry's rescuer. He's incredibly loyal. You know, he never thinks badly of Harry or Ron or Hermione. Like, I think he's just super loyal to Hogwarts, to Dumbledore. So I feel like he is just this sort of rescuer, this very, very loyal friend that you always would want to have on your side. And I think that, you know, Harry, probably from these very first moments, you know, loves that about him. He comes in and rescues Harry. He's hope and he's help in a very big package. And that's what Harry's been needing. So yeah, I love Hagrid. I think he's amazing.
I like him too. I was just curious because, again, a lot in the fandom, there's the one side of the spectrum who absolutely adore Hagrid, but then there's another part of the fandom who realize that as kind and as good-natured as Hagrid is, he does make questionable decisions and, again, involve the kids in questionable activities that isn't that entirely appropriate and responsible for him to do so. And I kind of lie somewhere in the middle, where it's like, yeah, like, I love him, he's great, but I also don't excuse, you know, those instances, because I believe they do have a point. But we'll, you know, we'll explore all of that later. So, should we get into Gothic Geek Out?
Sure.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So, what elements in these chapters did you find to be Gothic?
Well, I don't know if I'm correct in this because I don't know quite as much about Gothic literature and its themes like you guys do. But the
even though you wrote the fabulous book.
I know. Isn't that crazy? So in relation to that, I feel like, the Dursleys live in a house with a cupboard under the stairs, which is probably sort of a common thing. But I think that's more common now in older homes. And I definitely did put a cupboard in The Puppet Master's Apprentice, like a special secret cupboard. And old houses have all kinds of interesting nooks and crannies and like secret hiding places. So even though, well, I feel like it wasn't an ideal place for Harry to live, I love the idea of having like a cupboard under the stairs that I could go escape to and it would feel like maybe like a safe place. So I don't know if that sort of cupboard element is a Gothic element. What do you guys think?
Well, I think the notion of secret passages, but again, that's a huge part of, you know, Gothic literature and, you know, the intersection between Gothic literature and Gothic architecture. And yeah, it's certainly, it is an older home that would try to utilize space in that way by creating a cupboard under the stairs.
And the other Gothic element that I felt like stood out to me was the abandoned house on the rocky island where Hagrid comes to find them. I mean, it's a dark, stormy night. So really just the setting there feels very Gothic. You're in this sort of abandoned, you know, house with huge holes and the wind's blowing. And it's cold and miserable. And so that felt Gothic to me as well.
Yeah. What about you, Jess?
Well, Lisa, first of all, you reminded me when my nieces were like four, they used to always go, it was a dark and stormy night before they told the story. It was pretty cute. I think you definitely nailed one that I was going to point out with the place on the island and the dark and stormy night. It just kind of sets up that Gothic visual in your mind, you know. So, and then the second one was just to, again, reiterate the unwanted orphan with Harry and in the Dursleys and kind of elements of Jane Eyre a little bit, you know, just kind of the strongly disliked because of God knows why, really. You know, a giant Hagrid being there and there's a bit of magic, but I think we talked about this last time. I don't know if those two themes, especially in these two chapters, were as Gothic as... you know, just because it was supernatural. So my two main takeaways were, again, the orphan, Harry, and then the place on the lake. What about you, Miss Amy?
Well, of course, you know, hit the nail on the head. I think that the dark ambience of the shack on the rocky island is the quintessential Gothic setting. So that's a given. But also, I think there's two more. Like, I sort of kind of got Gothic-y vibes when, again, Hagrid is telling the story of what really happened to Harry's parents and just that, no, it wasn't just a random car crash. There was a dark, scary figure in a black robe that came to my house on Halloween night and killed my parents with a wand in a flashing green light.
Right.
Like, I certainly think that has, you know, Gothic themes and especially the notion of Gothic. There are secrets being revealed and really old family secrets being revealed. So you can kind of dig some Gothic stuff out of that. And then another thing, I don't know if it's truly Gothic. I don't know why I thought of it, but the rivalry between Petunia and Lily, the sisterly rivalry, kind of made me think of the Bronte sisters.
Okay. Yeah, that seems very
interesting.
I was just reading an article today about Emily seemed to have gotten along with both sisters, but apparently Charlotte and Anne Bronte really, or at least Charlotte was extremely jealous of Anne.
I didn't know
and
that.
And to the point that, I don't know if she had already passed away or not, but it got to a point where Charlotte kind of sabotaged or at least postponed the publication of Anne Bronte's, you know, Tenet of Wildfell Hall.
Wow.
And the implications of that are still felt to this day, where Anne is definitely lesser known than the other two sisters.
That is 100% true. Yeah.
Interesting. So, yeah, and I was just reading this because I just started reading Tenet or listening to Tenet of Wildfell Hall on audiobook.
Oh, I've never read that one. I need to add it to my list.
Yeah, well, I have a special Goodreads challenge where I want to read 100 books this year.
Oh my gosh.
That's great.
Yeah. So you know, rereading all the Harry Potter books slowly, that'll be 4 books. So excluding all the Harry Potter books I'm rereading, I have to read 8 books per month to reach that goal.
Wow.
Go you. I mean, yes. I have a Goodreads goal that I did 21 because it's 2021. So that's what I did.
That's great too. I haven't even set myself a goal. I'm just reading whenever I can. So you guys, I'm inspired.
So shall we move to famous quotes?
Let's do it.
Sure. Okay. My quote that I came up with is from Uncle Vernon in chapter 3. I'm not having one in the house. Again, one. Like, again, the all sorts of comparisons can be made with magic, with homosexuality, with transsexuality, with, again, differences of religion. Like, all of those things, I'm not having one in the house. Like, people have probably heard that a million times over in various of those tensions within families.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a powerful one.
What about you guys?
Mine, I picked out several. Oh, they're so hard to choose. But I'll pick another one from chapter 3 that really stood out to me. Other shelves were full of books. They were the only things in the room that looked as though they'd never been touched. And that's in reference to Harry moving up to that second bedroom of Dudley's, where he's like destroyed. You know, it's like a graveyard of all of Dudley's toys and stuff that he's destroyed, except for the books. And so I just feel like that's like so telling that obviously they don't value reading or things like that, for Harry to notice that.
That is very true. Like, they don't, you know, have a lot of books. And I think, you know, just by people like us, we put so much positive connotation and virtue onto books that if you like books, then you must innately be a better person than most people. But, yeah. What about you, Jess?
Well, mine is a little kind of silly. And I had to read it twice because I was like, was that a typo? But I think it's a testament to just how out of his mind Uncle Vernon was. It's no post on Sundays, he reminded them cheerfully as he spread marmalade on his newspapers. No damn letters today. And I read that a few times because, like I said, I thought I was sleeping outside. And I was like, did they really say he spread marmalade on his newspapers? So it was one of the times I paused. And then I think, again, it was kind of how distraught he was by receiving all these letters for Harry.
Indeed. And I think not just psychologically distraught, but I think he's also pretty sleep deprived. And see, yes. Being sleep deprived makes you do crazy stuff too.
Oh, I know that for sure.
Like, I remember reading like this study about an experiment of they made this one guy like not sleep, and he got to like 9 days without sleeping until finally he escaped his room and thought people were going to come kill him until they could finally sedate him and let him sleep again.
Oh my gosh.
Again, it's so nice we have ethics in psychology now.
Yeah, no kidding.
But alrighty then, and now we can move on to our last exercise, fan fiction time.
Yay!
So, Lisa, basically the way it works is, you know, you will give us a sort of question like, what if this happened differently? And Jess and I will come up with different answers.
Okay, this is fun. Well, I love that Hagrid's the one that comes to kind of collect Harry, because Hagrid's really our first introduction to Hogwarts and to Harry's family and history. But I think it'd be really interesting to either have a group of Hogwarts wizards teachers come, or maybe even just Dumbledore, to convey like how important Harry is to the wizarding world. So to me, it'd be interesting if it wasn't just Hagrid, but a whole pack of wizards and witches who came to really deal with the Dursleys and introduce themselves to Harry. Because I would love to see Dumbledore confront the Dursleys at this point, to see how he would react to realizing that Harry knows nothing about his past. Maybe he already knows that. Maybe he doesn't. I don't know. So that was my fanfic scenario, is what if a group of the teachers came, like McGonagall, Dumbledore, or even just Dumbledore instead of Hagrid or with Hagrid? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, do you want to tackle this, Jess, and I'll give mine?
Well, it's just funny because I had a similar thought, Lisa. I was like, what if Dumbledore brought the letter? How would how would that have changed the kind of exchange with the Dursleys? I think I would have been interested to see how he would have handled that. You know, it definitely would have been different than Hagrid, probably less aggressive and more, I don't know, what the more subtle and more, you know, kind of like subvert them a little bit. So it's funny that's the one you mentioned, because I specifically thought about Dumbledore rather than Hagrid. How about you, Miss Amy?
I think, yeah, if I'm thinking of, if it was specifically Dumbledore who came, again, it would have been more subtle, but there would have been like this quiet power about him. And I think there would have been more, not necessarily guilt, but more like, more on Petunia's side, because Dumbledore was the one who wrote the letter, like her having to deal more directly with, oh, I said I would do something and I didn't do it. Because Hagrid right. being the messenger, she can still be kind of sanctimonious and everything, but she couldn't really do that in the same way if Dumbledore himself was there.
Right.
Like, because this is the man who gave me the news that my sister died. I think it would have been left quieter, but I think stronger impact on the Dursleys. And I'm not going to lie, I guess I'm a very basic bitch. I too thought of the same scenario. What if someone else had come and collected Harry? But I didn't think necessarily that Dumbledore would do that. I actually would think that if any teacher were to come get him, it would be McGonagall.
Mm-hmm. That would be, do you think maybe she would have been, I would have loved to see the interaction between her and Petunia. Like, I'm just trying to imagine that, because again, McGonagall's so poised, and like, I just kind of always imagine Petunia as kind of like on the brink of just totally losing it. You know, somebody that tightly wound is probably just, I don't know. There's just in the kind of hatred and anger mm-hmm. that I don't see in McGonagall thus far. I don't know what's coming next, but
I think I would like that, or even McGonagall with Hagrid, where she's like the wit and he is the muscle, basically, to
good cop bad cop.
Yeah, exactly, to sort of put the fear in the Dursleys. I think that would be fun to see.
Yeah, and you know, I think it's not been directly stated, but in a lot of people's headcanon, it is McGonagall who actually goes, like, because basically, Harry's scenario is kind of similar to every other muggle-born or any other witch or wizard who was raised with a muggle family who doesn't know that magic exists. And there are some people like, you know, his friend Hermione Granger, who didn't know about magic, but not because her parents concealed it from her. You know, she genuinely didn't know about it. And so I think in a lot of people's headcanon, McGonagall is the one that will go to the Muggleborns and like explain everything to their parents and just be like, no, this isn't a hoax. Like, this is legit. And so I think in that way also, I don't think going to Harry would have been out of the scope of McGonagall's duties.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
And again, with McGonagall, we talked about this last episode, she is a half-blood. Her father was a Muggle. So she knows how to deal with Muggles. Again, she would definitely be more scathing and not as directly threatening as Hagrid, but certainly not hiding her contempt or disgust in a way that maybe Dumbledore might have.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But she would still be all, like, no nonsense, like, this is your list, like, this is what we're gonna do, we're gonna go get your stuff, and yada, yada, yada. If McGonagall were there, would she have taken the time to... I feel like if McGonagall had been there, I think maybe she would have explained that, yeah, your parents were wizards and you're wizards and clearly your Aunt Petunia has some baggage she's dealing with. But I have a feeling that she would not have told Harry exactly how your parents died. I think she would have left that maybe to Dumbledore to do if she had been the one to come.
I agree.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think Hagrid's just so in shock that Harry knows nothing, and he's like, just thinks it's such a travesty that he can't help himself. So he just goes ahead and tells him.
Yeah, and it's also not a question of, it's not that he can wait to tell him before he gets to Hogwarts. Like, they're going to go to Diagon Alley the next day. Like, they're going to go to the Wizarding World. They have to know he has to know something, so he isn't shocked.
Right, right.
Now, why do all these people keep staring at me?
Oh yeah, that and just like the overwhelmingness of all the things that, you know, he's going to encounter there. I I don't know, if I got like a school supply list that was like, get a wand and, or, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to put myself in his shoes. I guess maybe that would be another scenario. Like, what if they did let him get the letter, or he did just have the letter in early on? He would probably look at it. I mean, I would almost treat it like it's a hoax. I'd be like, this is bizarre. What are these people talking about? Like wizards and, you know, wands and things like that. It would be interesting to play out what he would do if he did get his hands on one of the letters, and they didn't have to go through this whole journey, you know, on the island and Hagrid bust down the door. But
I think if, yeah, again, if Harry had been smart enough to read his letter privately, I guess it would just depend on how much Harry is cognizant of, you know, again, all the things that happened with the snake and with the other exposition we're given about certain examples, how much credit he would give to that or not. I have a feeling that maybe he would read it, but still not fully believe it. And I feel like we may have had, maybe have had a Hagrid scenario in number 4 Privet Drive, because they would have opened the letter, but they would still have registered that he's not acting accordingly with automated email. So yeah, I feel like either way, we were going to get the Hagrid or whoever messenger, but it would just would have been more shocking to the to the Dursleys, because they wouldn't have anticipated it.
True. Yeah, that's what I would think as well, that we'd wind up with McGonagall or Hagrid coming right to the house.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. That would have been pretty intense for Hagrid to come to the house, and I'm sure Petunia would have lost her mind.
Yeah. The only other person or teacher I could think of coming to that would kind of take it upon themselves to, like, do this sort of work, to, like, explain everything, I think of Professor Sprout.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she's the head of Hufflepuff House, and she's really sweet. She's very kind. And I think if McGonagall is too busy, I think also she would have been a possibility to come. Although, again, she certainly would not have... She would have been way too polite to try and be nasty back to the Dursleys. Still would do her job and make sure Harry got the info he needed, but she wouldn't, like, certainly doesn't have the same emotional investment as Hagrid or even McGonagall, because both of those characters were there when they dropped off Harry.
Yeah.
Alrighty then, but I'm glad that it's Hagrid, because Hagrid's a good middleman, if you will.
Yeah.
And it sort of sets up for what's to come about Hagrid being the one then to take him, you know, to go shopping for supplies and stuff like that. He, like, sticks close to Harry and helps him out. So that makes those chapters really fun.
And even, like, thematically, like, within the series, we see a lot of Hagrid. Like, I think when I first read these series that I wasn't fully realizing how much of Hagrid was going to be a pivotal and, like, supporting character, and so it makes, you know, appropriate sense that he's the one that he's introduced in this way to Harry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree.
And that concludes episode 2 of The Rambling Ravenpuffs. Lisa, thank you so very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Amy. Thank you, Jess. This is so fun. Like I said, it was such fun homework to reread those chapters and think about what's going on there. And that was just a complete delight. So thank you again for asking me. Loved it.
Of course. And for our listeners, tune in next time. We will read chapters 5 and 6 of Sorcerer's Stone, Diagon Alley, and The Journey from Platform 9 3/4. And if you're interested in posting a question, join our Facebook group, the Ravenpuff Common Room. Catch you guys later. Bye.
Bye. Bye.